and welcome to the 7th Annual History of the Health Sciences Lecture Series. The lecture this afternoon is co-sponsored by the Division of Plastic Surgery, and our speaker is Richard Boyce Stark, who's clinical professor of surgery here at PNS. Dr. Hugo sends his regrets this afternoon. He's unable to be here to introduce our speaker, but he had to be in Washington today, and some of you may have seen him on the Today Show. In the library, along with the lecture series, we have an exhibit that will be running for about a month, and its title is the same as our lecture, Yankee Doodle Doctors. The exhibit focuses on medical care and physicians of the Revolutionary War period. Also in the library, following this lecture, we will have a sherry hour that we invite you all to attend. It will be in the conference room in the library. And during this sherry hour, we are pleased to exhibit some pictures that were done by Dr. Stark, some drawings of his, and they're all on exhibit there. The library looks like a gallery almost, and I'm sure that Dr. Stark will be able to tell you more about his artwork. Let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Stark. Now, I know for most of you, you don't need to have any introduction, but let me just say that he is a plastic surgeon. He's trained at Stanford Medical School and at Cornell University Medical College. In addition to being a plastic surgeon, Dr. Stark is also an historian. He's published widely in a variety of historical topics, with a special interest in the Revolutionary War period. And he is also an artist, and you'll see evidence of that later this afternoon. For right now, let me introduce Dr. Stark, who's going to talk to us about Yankee Doodle Doctors, Medical Care of the Revolutionary War. Dr. Stark.
Committee, ladies, gentlemen, I think if we could dim the lights a wee bit, not too much. And I will need the podium light. This handsome structure is the Delancey Mansion, which is the oldest building in New York City. In former times, converted into a tavern called the Queen's Head, and later Francis Tavern, named after the proprietor, Samuel Francis, from the West Indies. Here, on 3 December, 1783, an historic and dramatic drama transpired. Here it was that George Washington said farewell to his officer corps. The occasion filled Washington with sorrow, and it was indeed a poignant scene. Raising his glass, Washington summoned all of his composure and said, "With a heart full of gratitude and love, I now take leave of you. I most devoutly wish that your latter days will be as prosperous and happy as your former ones have been glorious and honorable." Led by Knox, chief of the artillery, the book dealer from Boston, they came singly and tearfully to press the hand of their commander, who instead embraced each one. Hamilton, Steuben, Green, Clinton, Wayne, Schuyler, Gates, Putnam, Stark, Kosciuszko, and Talmadge. It was finally over, and the commander reeled towards the stairs leading to the street. The honor guard snapped to attention. Halfway down, a giant of a soldier who had been with Washington at Trenton broke ranks to wring the hand of his chief. Soon the entire squad was embracing the overwrought Washington. The streets below were crowded. A cheer that billowed up soon became a wail. The crowd parted, and Washington, blinded by tears, made his way to a decorated barge at Whitehall Ferry. As he was rowed across the North River towards New Jersey, a mighty lament followed. So ended 9 long, enervating, mostly disappointing, but occasionally joyous years, which turned the world upside down. At River's Edge, Washington was met by a carriage with outriders. Alone in the carriage, emotionally drained, Washington sank back and closed his eyes. A kaleidoscope of memories of the 9 revolutionary years passed in review before the commander. The devotion and bravery of his officers were eclipsed when he recalled the chicanery and the internecine feuding amongst his doctors. 2 of his director generals of the medical corps court-martialed, a 3rd dismissed for incompetence. Imagine. When Washington took command of the colonial forces in Cambridge in July of 1775, he found that he had a ragtag militia for an army, and his medical corps consisted of a few surgeons of the regiments of the New England militia, and they were no help to him at all. And he had himself to institute basic rules of camp sanitation. The court-martial, which sat continuously since his arrival, there were so many problems, soon court-martialed 2 regimental surgeons, 1 for selling drugs and the other for selling bogus medical discharges. At about the same time that Washington arrived in Cambridge, also arriving was Dr. Benjamin Church, who had just returned from the Continental Congress meeting in Philadelphia. It was he who was appointed Director General of what was called the hospital, not the medical corps, which was Washington's choice, but the hospital. And how glad Washington was to see him. There were so many things to do. But lo and behold, Church, who was an avowed patriot, one of the most notable along with Sam Adams, was charged with treason. He was found sending a note in code to the commander of the British fleet off Newport, giving troop and artillery strength, as well as killed and wounded reports from Bunker Hill and from Lexington and Concord. Who now would be the director general? Washington is back to square one. He learned through his own intelligence, which he paid for out of his pocket, that it was between 2 Philadelphia friends, John Morgan and William Shippen, Jr. They had been boyhood friends, gone to the same school. They had each apprenticed with a master, Morgan with John Redmond, and Shippen with his father, William Shippen, Sr. Both had attended college, Morgan to the College of Philadelphia, later the University of Pennsylvania, and Shippen to the College of New Jersey, later, of course, Princeton. Following this, the report went on, the 2 left together for Europe to complete their medical education, and they had a year with John and William Hunter in London, and later went on to Edinburgh, where each graduated after an arduous course with an MD degree. There was something else there that made Washington warm a bit to each one. He found out that Morgan had served as a militia surgeon in the French and Indian War, a war in which Washington himself had fought with Braddock at Fort Duquesne. And so he thought rather kindly of Morgan. And then there was the news also that Shippen had come back from Europe with a new bride, Alice Lee, sister of Richard Henry and Francis Lightfoot Lee of Virginia, old friends of Washington. So he warmed to both. And he found choice would be John Morgan. When Morgan arrived, which he did late, 6 weeks late, which didn't help, he found out that there was so much to do, and to his dismay, that there was already a separate, but not quite equal, medical corps that already existed. And this consisted of the regimental surgeons that served each of the militia of the various units from New England that were surrounding the British at Boston. They were a scurrilous bunch, and Morgan was to have a great deal of trouble with them. He found out that they had not been chosen by merit at all. Indeed, the Massachusetts Provincial Assembly had decreed, quote, "Great uneasiness may arise in the army by the appointment of surgeons who may not be agreeable to the officers and soldiers in their respective regiments. Therefore, it was voted to allow the colonel of each regiment to nominate the surgeon for his own unit." The colonel was the one who had recruited the troops. He may have had no military training whatsoever, and he brought in his crony, probably his drinking friend, as his surgeon. Morgan got to work, though, and had to do so many things. He had to do them all himself. There was no quartermaster to get his supply, no corps of engineers to construct the buildings. He had to go out and buy, sometimes out of his own pocket, hemp cloth and linen for dressings, and he had to scrounge in the fields and forests for herbs and barks and minerals with which to come up with medications that were now lacking, since all of this was interdicted from London. He had to come up with laudanum, which was opium used for cough and diarrhea and for pain. He had to come up with mercury, the specific for dermatoses and for venereal disease at a time when syphilis and gonorrhea were thought to be the same disease. Also sulfur, which was used for body lice, the vector of what was called jail and hospital fever, which we now know of as typhus, and quinine, the bark, which was used for intermittent fever or malaria. Instruments themselves were hard to come by. The instrument makers were busy forging swords and bayonets for the military. And Washington himself had to appeal to the citizens of Massachusetts for blanket. At this time, Morgan was able to get Washington's ear and to buoy to him the idea that he wanted only doctors in the hospital, that the regiments could have the physicians, but he wanted doctors. "But isn't one as good as another?" Washington had asked, "in your circumstances?" "Not at all. There's a very great and vast difference." And then he explained. A physician, of which there were about 3,000 in the colonies, take care of a population of 3,000, was usually trained by being apprenticed to a master. And this began usually in adolescence, about the age of 15. And it cost the family of the apprentice about $100 a year at a time when a good slave cost $20, so it was a lot of money. And this went on, this servitude went on. All the while, the apprentice was the apothecary, filling prescriptions. He would help in the house. He was the house boy, he was the messenger boy, he was the housekeeper, and he was the stable boy. It said that he went from stable boy to surgeon. That was the common thing that was brewing around at that time. Mostly, though, he helped with the patients, with dressing, occasionally dental extraction. Rarely with a major procedure such as lithotomy, as you see being done here, with perineal cystotomy, bereft anesthesia, or an amputation or a tree finding of the skull. But these things were not common. He also helped, though, with the treatments that were phlebotomy or were cupping or the administration of glycers. The perceptive apprentice would say to the master, "What are we accomplishing by these procedures?" And the master, who was also a teacher, would say that all of us are composed of different humors in different proportions, and that makes up for our individuality. Those in whom blood predominates are sanguine, cheerful and optimistic. Those in whom phlegm dominates are brave and serene. Those in which yellow bile from the gallbladder is in ascendancy are argumentative and contentious, while those who are dominated by black bile from the pancreas usually are hypochondriacal and depressed. If all these humors are in balance, the master would say, we're in a state of eucrasia. If not, we have dyscrasia, and then with these procedures, we must get rid of the pathogenic humors, which are the ones that are producing the disease. We must get rid of the morbific matter. This is done by phlebotomy or by cupping, which formed a blood blister, a type of slow bleed, or is done by sweating, get rid of the excessive phlegm, a bit like our modern day sauna, and to get rid of the yellow bile and the black bile, there were the emetics, the purgatives, and the glycers, on up to the notorious tobacco enema. But this is what the master would say to them. But in another time, this is perhaps a different interpretation. Finally, this was over. It took so long, but when the time came, a certificate was written in hand by the master, which was registered in the court, and the apprentice then could call himself a physician and could practice medicine, and usually was given a small pocket set of instruments and a library. And the library might be fairly good. It could have perhaps books by Hermann Boerhaave, Leiden, or Gerhard von Swieten from Vienna, or from the British Isles, Thomas Sydenham, William Cullen, The Hunters, Percival Potts, or William Vine. But there are many more physicians than there are doctors. You mentioned 3,000 at Washington, yes? And of the doctors, the ones with an MD degree, there are about 350, answered Morgan. Most of these have gotten their degree in Europe, perhaps in Leiden, in the Netherlands, Rheims, Paris, most though in Edinburgh, and a small number, perhaps 100, have gotten their degree at the two colonial schools that are now extant, one of which I founded, he assured Washington, and the other being present in New York City. Why do they mostly go to Edinburgh, was the question. Family roots, largely, English spoken, Protestant, but above all, Scotland, Edinburgh particularly, gave an MD degree, whereas the hospital schools of London gave only a bachelor of medicine. The course was long, and indeed to enroll at all, one had to have had 3 years at a university, and there were seven courses that were very intensive, and ward rounds were conducted here at the Royal Infirmary, bedside ward rounds instituted at that time. And this school had been started about 50 years before the American Revolution. To get the MD degree finally, there had to be a thesis written in Latin and defended before the whole faculty, quite like the MD degree today in Europe, and the oral examination, final oral examination, was in Latin before two members of the faculty. Tell me about the colonial schools at Washington. Well, the first one is the one that I founded, although Shippen claimed some responsibility. We both had finished at Edinburgh. I took another year and took the grand tour of Europe, while Shippen with his new bride, Alice Lee, came home to start teaching anatomy and male midwifery, the precursor of the male obstetrician here in Philadelphia, way back in 1765, which is the time we're talking about. This was not really a school in any sense of the word, but when I arrived, I brought with me a letter from Thomas Penn, the son of William Penn, who recommended to the trustees of the College of Philadelphia that medical professors be added to their faculty. And so it was in 1765 when the faculty of two started the school. 3 years later, there was an increase in the faculty, and eight persons had graduated with a degree from the College of Philadelphia. The most notable of the three added was Benjamin Rush, about whom we shall hear something shortly. There was another younger chap than Shippen and me, continued Morgan, Samuel Bard. He was several years behind us. He trained as an apprentice with his father, John Bard. And when he came back, the two of them had gotten together to found a King's College down on the Church of England ground between Trinity Church, which you see, and St. Paul's Chapel. this was a more expanded faculty, and it opened its doors 2 years after the College of Philadelphia, 1757. The faculty consisted of six, the most notable here being John Jones, who was an excellent surgeon, later Washington's physician, who had written the very first text in the American College, the very first medical text in the American College, plain, concise, and practical remarks on the treatment of wounds and fractures, with an appendix there on camp and hospital. Military medicine, I think that's what it says. There being no hospital in New York, similar to the Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia, with John Jones again, who came up with the plan for the New York Hospital, which was built and opened its doors in 1771. Below, in dotted lines above, was added at a later time. Well, after this, and as he concluded, Morgan asked Washington if he had any objection to his examining the doctors, the MDs that he was getting into the hospital. This is perfectly agreeable to Washington, and so it was done, and these men were better placed as a result. Then when Morgan proposed examining the physicians, the regimental surgeons, a great howl of protest went up over the insult, and so Morgan backed off. But there was already this altercation between the hospital and the regimental surgeons. All the while that Morgan was so busy trying to establish this thing, getting commandeering houses and getting the equipment and supplies and the doctors and examining and putting them in the proper spot, he was continually badgered by a person named Samuel Stringer, who wrote from Fort Ticonderoga requesting supplies and instruments. It was an incessant barrage from Stringer. Finally, Morgan had had it, and he said, damn this fellow, I don't know who he is. I don't know what relationship he has to me or to the hospital or to the regimental surgeon. Never been explained to me. And he rejected each request. Whereupon Stringer went to Philadelphia to lobby his cause, and Morgan appealed to Congress to clarify the chain of command, who ranked whom. Congress had gotten a bit of this in the past and would get much more in the future, and they began to feel that title and rank were very much weighing much too heavily on John Morgan and Samuel Stringer. As the British left Boston, which they did, about half a year after Washington had arrived, for Halifax later to appear in the New York scene, they left behind a large medical cache, about 50 instrument kits, very elaborate ones, which were pure gold, as you can imagine, to poor old Morgan. He divvied these up with the regimental surgeons, but they all they did was to clamor for more. And now they wanted all supplies from them, not just medical supplies. So again, old Morgan went back to Congress, decreed that no, they could only get medical things from the hospital, whereupon the regimental surgeons blamed Morgan for the rejection and not Congress. And now they were off for Morgan's hide. By now, the indications were that the battle was moving south. The British had quitted Boston, and in the interim, on 4 July 1776, with the Declaration of Independence, there was an upsurge in morale, but everyone knew deep in their heart that this thing had to be won on the battlefield. Feeling a bit uncertain about their position in the capital city of Philadelphia, Congress now established a small home guard and militia force called the Flying Camp to repel any British thrust at the capital. It's Surgeon William Shippen, Jr. During the New York campaign, which is largely a debacle, Morgan was trying to anticipate the next move and was in New Jersey trying to establish hospitals there. And he came across Shippen one day, who was not at all friendly, in fact, quite surly. He said, what the hell are you doing here? Morgan said, well, I'm establishing hospitals. I'm the Director General. He said, this isn't your jurisdiction. I'm the Director General of this area. Bewildered, Morgan had not heard anything about this. Again, he went to Congress. And they decreed that the jurisdiction between the two men, two old friends, now the two rivals, was the Hudson. But by now, Washington had lost the whole game. He'd lost Fort Washington, Fort Lee, and indeed he was running for his life across New Jersey. Jersey with Cornwallis in hot pursuit. So the whole question of the Hudson being the borderline of division line of authority was academic. Morgan now went to Congress to sort this whole thing out. He was baffled. Sam Adams, who was a member of the medical committee, was very cool, gave him cool treatment. Benjamin Rush, who had quit the College of Philadelphia and is now a member of the medical committee, was heard to remark to a friend he's glad he wasn't in Morgan's shoes. The jittery Congress now made two moves. First of all, it moved its venue to Baltimore for safety, and it removed its two greatest irritants with this directive. Dr. John Morgan, Director General, and Dr. Samuel Stringer, Director of the Hospital in the Northern Department, are hereby dismissed from further service in said offices. Right. Now, Shipman was not only the de facto Director General, but was so appointed by the Congress. Shipman was quite smug about his ability to make this thing work. He had the best medical education. His in-laws were the powerful leads of Virginia. His own family was prominent in Pennsylvania. He'd had experience with a flying camp, hospitalizing the wounded at Easton and Allentown and Bethlehem. He had competent lieutenants in Jonathan Potts and John Cochran. And he could get along with people, which Morgan never could. But he was faced with the same problem, the regimental surgeon, eternal shortages, inflation, money not worth a continental, the failure of Congress to understand the magnitude of the medical problem, the ongoing rivalries and jealousies characteristic of doctors. And he had one problem that he did not share with Morgan. He was lazy. Shortly after he was appointed, he presented to Washington and to the Congress a reorganization plan for the hospital. The last plan had been churches way, way back. And this had been to establish a hospital with four surgeons and 20 surgical maids. Imagine how preposterous this was when over 1,200 would serve in the hospital in the course of the war. We started with four, and now the plan obviously had to be augmented. This was the work of John Cochran, who was a volunteer. He wasn't in the military at all, a chap from New Jersey, who had married Philip Schuyler's daughter. But he had served for 4 years with the British Army in the Medical Corps in the French and Indian War, in their Medical Corps. And the hospital, as he enlarged it, was patterned largely after the British plan and much more costly. The Inspector General of the hospital, for example, was paid more than the Major General of the line. But in spite of all of this, and his good lieutenants, and his in-laws, and his education, his ability to get along with people, things went downhill. First to point out the failures, and to do so very, very vociferously, was Benjamin Rush. Now he's changed jobs again. He's now the Physician General of the Middle Department. Remember, he started as Professor of Chemistry at the College of Philadelphia. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence, a member of the Medical Committee of Congress. And here he was now pointing the finger at Shipman for all of the mistakes. He had a great laundry list of things that were to be done. And when Shipman refused to undertake these reforms, Rush had no alternative but to resign. All the while, Morgan was in the wings, pitiably petitioning Congress to exonerate him for his abrupt and unjustified dismissal, as he saw it. And much later, Congress finally decreed, quote, they were satisfied with the conduct of John Morgan, our Director General and Physician-in-Chief of the General Hospital of the U.S. Morgan had always had an inborn paranoia that it was actually Shipman who had cashiered him out. And it took him just 3 days after the vindication to institute court-martial proceedings against Shipman. Old friend. The trial was held in Morristown. It took 6 months. The testimony and the allegations were vicious, vindictive. and also very tedious. And in the testimony, it was brought out that Shipman expended little time caring for or about the wounded, and that he had profiteered by selling army wine and sugar for his own gain. In a very confused verdict, Congress half-censored Shipman while at the same time exonerating him. Morgan went wild, and he fed the media a long tirade that was much too personal. This was printed. First, the public showed disdain, and finally, indifference. Unable to bear much more abuse, Shipman finally resigned, whereupon Morgan passed out handbills that he had printed himself, congratulating the public on a triumph of virtue. Three gone. Three director generals. Who was to be the fourth? Many were considered, even including Morgan. Washington, however, sometime before, had commended another. He said, "I want to take the liberty of mentioning a gentleman who I think highly deserving of notice. This gentleman is Dr. John Cochran, well known to all the medical faculty. He has distinguished himself at winter camp in Morristown as a volunteer, particularly in his attention to the smallpox patients and the wounded." Congress appointed Cochran Director General, remarking, "While other gentlemen high in the medical staff were disgusting the public with mutual charges and incrimination, Dr. Cochran always preserved the character of an able physician and honest man." The carriage hit a rut, jolting the musing Washington back into the present. He opened the blind and looked out. The light of the moon flooded out the dark thoughts of his doctors, and his mood brightened as he recalled his personal victories not only over the British, but the even greater enemy, the smallpox. Back he went in time. He was 19 and taking the only trip he was to make outside the colony, and which was to begin the smallpox leitmotif of his career. Washington and his half-brother Lawrence had arrived in the fall of 1751 in Bridgetown, staying at these two houses, and Washington was almost immediately infected because in 2 weeks' time he came down with a fulminating case of variola or of smallpox, and he was isolated for 26 days. His 6'3" powerful physique obviously was a factor in his survival, but it is fortunate for the colonies and for the United States today that he had had this disease, for no official position requiring prolonged service was conferred on one who could be carried away so rapidly by this disease. This is the way a person so infected looks with the evanescent pox, which can pit, of course, and cause the loss of eyebrows and cilia, the eyelashes, and cause stenosis sometimes of the nasal airway. Washington himself was pockmarked as a result of his infection, but as Parson Weems said, rather more attractively than otherwise. Washington's principal portraitist, Gilbert Stuart, who did three live portraits of Washington, from which he made innumerable copies and a large fortune, never portrayed this facial scarring. Rather an interesting aside about Stuart. He had escaped the war, wanting no part of it, and had gone to England to study with Benjamin West, the American who later became the first president of the Royal Academy. He was with him 5 years, and his portraits it improved. He became very successful, but his elaborate lifestyle kept him constantly in debt. He conceived the idea of painting President Washington and making many copies as a way out of his financial dilemma. Because he had avoided the war, Washington avoided Stuart. Finally, the president was prevailed on to sit for Stuart, who found the commander-in-chief very cool. And it was not until midway through the second portrait that Stuart began to talk horses that Washington warmed to the artist. I might say parenthetically that of this Vaughan, this is the so-called Vaughan portrait, or Mr. Vaughan in Pennsylvania, there are 15 copies, known copies of this, and one called the Athenaeum that was never quite finished There are 75 known copies. So a very good place to make a living. Back in Cambridge, at about the time, or just before Morgan had arrived, Washington had launched a two-pronged attack on French Canada, hoping to make it the 14th colony. And he sent this force north under Montgomery and under Benedict Arnold without any medical care at all. Montgomery captured Montreal, but the troops were desperately ill with the smallpox. They moved on to Quebec, where Benedict Arnold was waiting. The enlistments of most of this group were up within about a week's time, so the order to attack was given. The sickly force was routed. It was a disaster. Montgomery was killed, Morgan wounded. Soldiers who enlistments were up went home, and the others fell back to Ticonderoga, which was a sickly pest hole riddled with smallpox, from which Washington concluded he was defeated not by the British, but by the smallpox. Also in Boston, the same problem plagued him. In 1773, before he arrived, at the time of the Tea Party, the Boston court was closed by the British and the town was occupied. The colonial army, this miserable group of militia, surrounded them and in effect were besieging the British, but nobody made a move because Boston was full of smallpox. And knowing this, Washington was very, very cautious. He wrote a number of times to Congress about this. First, I've been particularly attentive to the least symptom of the smallpox, every person removed to the isolation hospital at Sewell's Point as soon as noticing the disease. His intelligence told him that the British had inoculated several soldiers with pus from the vesicle of the smallpox victim and then sent them outside of Boston to spread the disease amongst the colonial line, the early form of germ warfare. Washington now was able to get a number of cannons hauled over ground from Ticonderoga and put them on high ground, and with the prospect of being shelled by the artillery, the British moved out. That was when they sailed for Halifax, later to appear in the New York area. But Washington was afraid to move into Boston, even though the British had gone. Sometime after they had sailed, he wrote Congress that I have ordered 1,000 men who have had the smallpox under the command of General Israel Putnam to take possession. Here he is using immune troops. And a week later, hospital and regimental surgeons are to examine carefully the troops. And whenever they discover the smallest symptom of smallpox, they are without delay to send the patient to the smallpox hospital, his plan for isolation. With these precautions, Washington got a reprieve from the smallpox, but it crept up again during the New York campaign, and his troops were riddled with it. At the time of his twin masterpieces of Trenton and Princeton. Although patriotic fervor was rising now after the New York debacle, still enlistments were way down because there was this awful dread of the fatal smallpox with which his troops were infected. He pulled into winter camp at Morristown after the Battle of Princeton. And his troops were in Jockey Hollow in log huts similar to this. While he had his headquarters here at the Ford Mansion. This reprieve, this winter reprieve, gave him time to approach his decimating medical enemy. And how decimating it had been was shown by troop strength figures for the year before, 1776. His army had suffered 1,000 wounded and 10,000 sick, mostly of smallpox, 10-1. In his command post, the small room where he wrote all of his directives by hand, this precursor, earliest of our pentagons, Washington was to try to fathom a way out of this dilemma. Was the disease, he asked himself, to dissolve my small army without any hope of resurgence of enlistments? Enlistments are not coming in. What were his options? He tried to figure this out. He had so botched it in the past. The disease had prevented his attack, his occupation of Boston. made a total exercise in futility of his Canadian campaign. Well, he could isolate the sick, but that wasn't noticeably successful in Boston. He could use immune troops, but their numbers were patently too small to be meaningful. Or he could use mercenary troops, as the British were using the Hessians. Apropos of this, he wrote to Congress, "If the army which I hope we shall have in the field this year is suffered to smolder away by sickness as it did in the last, we must look for reinforcements from other places than from our state." He gave it a very, very thorough investigation. Or, he concluded, or he could avoid these half measures and inoculate the whole army. But what of inoculation, or variolation as it's properly called? What was it? How long had it been used? Where did it come from? Variolation consisted of placing a virus from the pock or pustule of an infected person on the area of the arm scarified by a needle or by a lancet. The person variolated traded a mini form of smallpox with very few pustules and virtually no symptoms for lifelong immunity. It's not known how long variolation had been used. However, back in 1713, Dr. Edward Timoney of Constantinople, a graduate of Edinburgh, had written in the Proceedings of the Royal Society of the use of variolation in his city of Constantinople for 40 years. That would place it back about 100 years before the Revolutionary War. A leading English feminist of the period and wife of the British ambassador to Turkey, Mary Wortley Montagu, had attended a ceremony in Istanbul and Constantinople, in which young children were variolated. Afraid of the lancet and of the needle, they were diverted by singing and dancing and refreshment. But a wholesale variolation took place. And she was determined to have her only son inoculated. And later, she enthused the royal family of King George I of England to use this ounce of prevention. Word of this prophylactic inoculation spread to the American colonies where the battle lines formed. The ministers were in favor, and I'm sorry to say the doctors were against. After the Reverend Cotton Mather had his two children inoculated by Dr. Zebdiel Boylston during the Boston smallpox epidemic of 1721, the practice became somewhat widespread, but by no means universal, since a few of those treated died as a result of the inoculation. Death rate from smallpox contracted the natural way. It was about 5 times greater than than from variolation. And the course of the mini disease was half as prolonged as the disease contracted the natural way. At this point, Washington, in one of the greatest medical decisions ever made by a military commander, I believe, ordered his troops and all future recruits inoculated, segregated into smallpox hospitals, and their clothing exchanged for new. The orders germane to this massive public health program were relayed on to his new director general, William Shippen, and Washington was helped most, not only by Shippen, but by Jonathan Potts, who performed a similar humanitarian feat in Ticonderoga, and by John Cochran, as I say, who was serving merely as a volunteer. To put this military medical decision into perspective, Washington's mass variolation, antedated by 21 years, the report of Edward Jenner before the Royal Society upon vaccination with cowpox as cross immunity against smallpox. Jenner's report was 1798. In the first 3 months of 1777, mass inoculation was carried out upon troops in winter quarters in Morristown and in Philadelphia. Also inoculated were all recruits in New York, New Jersey, New England, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. Soldiers went through the procedure in divisions at intervals of 5 to 6 days. Private homes served as treatment centers and isolation centers with guards posted. As the grand experiment moved to its climax, Washington was able to write enthusiastically, "Inoculation has been attended by amazing success." And finally, militarily, in the fall of 1777, Burgoyne, the British commander, moved south via the north-south waterway of Lake Champlain and Lake George, trying via the Hudson River to hook up with the British commander Clinton in New York, and thus to isolate New England. Over-baggaged and out-generaled by Horatio Gates and Benedict Arnold, Burgoyne surrendered his decimated force of 5,000 plus valuable military supplies at Saratoga. Following this immensely important and decisive battle, the French formed an alliance with the United States, which was tantamount to declaring war on England. And for the first time, the colonialists were to have uniforms and a decent musket. And this alliance with France was, in 1781, to bring final victory at Yorktown. Lord Cornwallis had been fighting in the south, and now was placed in charge of 7,000 British troops, in raiding plantations on the peninsula east of Richmond along the James River. Washington learned that the French fleet under de Grasse would quit the Caribbean and be off the Atlantic coast. With Rochambeau, Washington led a force of 10,000 American and French upon a forced march from New York to the peninsula. And at the same time, de Grasse and the French fleet blocked Cornwallis' escape by sea. Cornwallis, the Fox, was trapped. Following an 11-day siege, ceasefire was signed in the Moore House, which you see here, and the British marched between French and American lines to lay down their arms as the band played "The World Turned Upside Down." Thank you. Using the live virus of smallpox, yeah. Now, he didn't know anything about the cross immunity. Now, this was unattenuated live virus, which could kill, and especially if used with a lancet, which, of course, is a scalpel, and make a large slice. And the resultant morbidity and sometimes mortality is directly a dose-related thing. Much better use. And they used to protect the area using a walnut, which was strapped over the vaccinated area. And it was not known for a long, long time that even though you'd been variolated, you were very infected. And this had been tried up at Ticonderoga. It's called a test house, but they had no, and Stringer was asking for medicine and so forth. He had nothing up there, no blankets, he had no bed, and no medicine. And in despair, some of the people who had read about the variolation were trying it. But there's no isolation of it, and so what they did was merely spread it throughout the real great disaster. They had just one of the real things for them. The variolation? Zebdiel Boylston was the one who really put it on rather firm ground, although it was used intermittently from the 1721 epidemic right up to the Revolutionary War, a period of 50 years. It was used in South Carolina and in other areas. Boylston did over 150 variolations, and he lost only one. But that came rather early, and there was a great hue and cry, and many people backed off. There was a lot of mystique about this thing, a lot of superstition, and many people felt that we were tampering with God's will. And so Cotton Mather, actually, because he had applauded public opinion, which was largely against, and had his own children variolated, received a bomb one day, related to a bomb, which misfired. Out part of the house, but it did not kill it. Violent about this thing. One aside about Mary Wortley Montagu, she was really one of the early great feminists. And it was her prevailing on Princess Caroline and the royal family to have the children variolated that really allowed it to take off. societies which reached America and that had a great influence on acceptance. She herself had had the disease and had lost her eyebrows and her eyelashes and was pocked, and she lost a brother who died of it. So she felt very strongly about this. So strongly that she had her own doctor come out from England, Dr. Maitland, come all the way out to Turkey, which wasn't probably eating that day, she was very late as a child, which he later did to the royal family. A lot of nice little interesting small stories. I don't know numbers. I can just say that at the time, all of them were the extant ones, the recruits, and thereafter, the recruits became a standing order. They had to eat. And they had to change clothes as people arrived. A lot of them were getting into clothes that had been effectively contacted others. It was a big operation there at a time when they were just getting uniforms. A lot of people in Morristown died, though, from their exposure to this. There was a backfiring. Over 30, I think it was. The townspeople ended up underground because of this effect. And they weren't always able to isolate the people who lived here and there, which was tragic. Yes, Janet? I think it was, but I don't have any information. I've forgotten about that. I'll look that up. Morristown, though, is very important to Washington. We live so near, so few of us have been there to see it. He wintered camp twice there, and it was really the place that he was able to restore the vigor of the army, far more than I think Valley Forge, very important town. Ford Mansion still stands, the wonderful museum, and there are about 40 log huts out there in Jockey Hollow. There may have been more built since I've been there, but it's well worth seeing. I recommend taking the children. Thank you. They fell back, John, right after the first of the year of 76. The attack, the force went up in 75, and about February, they fell back to Sorel. There's a little town of Sorel, and then they fell back to Ticonderoga. And it was horrible for a long time, horrible. Horatio Gates was up there, a great commander, and this fellow Jonathan Potts, who really is another hero that received very little attention, who died in the war, actually.